How do you explain prayer to a non-Buddhist? And what is the difference between Buddhist prayer and praying to God?
Generally, I think, I don't know exactly, but I think that prayer is a kind of expression of a deep wish from within yourself, you know? And when you make that wish, then there are different ways of expressing that. One way is like aspiration. May this happen. I would like to have that, like have like this. That's also, you know, expression of a wish, but it's a way of expression is more like an aspiration. I want something. Now, when you say prayer, then that's also, the prayer is also an aspiration. Usually prayer is an aspiration. When you talk about prayer from the point of view of that kind of prayer, you know, like expressing the an aspiration. But then, I think that in Tibet or in Buddhism, you know, we have different words. I think this is important to know, because it's a little bit, when you say prayer, it's it kind of translates into many different words in Tibetan, for instance. There is one word called Soldep. Soldep. You know, you are all studying Tibetan, no? Soldep is a little bit like prayer in Christianity, that you are praying to something, for something, yeah. Like you pray to your Lama or to the Buddha or to the Bodhisattvas, more with kind of devotion or, you know, a certain kind of faith and things like that. And there, it's like, it's somewhat like the prayer in Christianity. And the difference is, I think, the philosophy behind. When you, like in Christianity, I think you, when you think about God, you think about, well, maybe different people have different ways of understanding God. That's another matter. But generally, I mean, you believe it's a creator. And also there is a kind of concept that if, you know, if God is pleased, then I will be, you know, like blessed. And if he is displeased, I will be kind of punished, more or less. Now, in Buddhist terms, when you talk about the Buddha Dhamma and things like that, Buddha Sangha and, you know, Bodhisattvas, then there is not that concept. The Buddhas are displeased or pleased is not a question. The Buddhas and enlightened beings, we talk about the activities. I'm sure you have studied this, you know, the activity of a Buddha in some texts. What did you study? Jhulama. In Jhulama there's a long, I don't know whether you were there in that class, but the activity is said to be spontaneous and spontaneous and effortless. Yeah? The example given is like sun and its ray moon and its reflection. It is said that this is a very traditional example, that if you go on a full moon night and clear sky, then somebody goes with a bowl of water outside, is a reflection. Million people go out, there are million reflections. After a million, then it's not more kind of unclear. It's, it's as clear as... And then after a few millions, then it starts to sweat. It's not like that, same. It doesn't matter how many, So that's the way, from Buddhist point of view, that the blessing is not about giving. There's no question whether the enlightened beings would give blessing or not. The blessing is always there. So therefore, blessing is only for receiving. And this is always, of course, everything in Buddhism is based on interdependent, dependent arising. So therefore, whatever subject comes up, you have to go back to that, dependent arising. And there you will find the explanation from Buddhist point of view. So therefore, the prayer is like that. It's a, the solnip, when you make solnip, then if your mind is, you can say pure or open enough, then it creates circumstances that would, open those possibilities and, something changes or something happens. That's the kind of solnip. Then there is something called melam. Melam is a wishing prayer. You can also sometimes invoke the blessings of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and their kind of their power or their positive deeds, result of their positive deeds. But generally, it is just a wish. May all beings have happiness and causes of happiness. That's a melam. Yeah. Things like that. Then there is moa. That's also prayer. And this moa is dedication. We call it dedication. But that's also prayer. Mm-hmm. That, whatever positive deeds that I did or I have done in the past, I am doing now, I will be doing in future, all of them I put together, and the power of that may happen to end all the sufferings of the beings and things like that, whatever, that's the dedication. And then prayer also, like aspiration in the beginning, may I become enlightened so that I can be, helpful to all the sentient, things like that. So all these things you can kind of include in prayers, And sometimes the prayer is so big that whole sadhana is called a prayer. But it's not only prayer, the whole sadhana is lots of things. It's part of meditation and things like that. And sometimes I think people call meditation also prayer. Yeah? Mm. So that depends on what you mean by prayer. Prayer can mean, I think, lots of things. Yeah.
Is there a difference between the accumulation of merit and the elimination of obscurations? Mm. And the second part of that question is, how can merit, which is compounded, lead to Buddhahood, which is uncompounded?
I think accumulation is merit and purification is more or less same. The same. I think so. Although it is, put in a different ways, It comes to the same thing because... of course, the way doing is a little bit different, no? Accumulate merit means doing more positive things. Yeah? The more you positive things you do, the more you, kind of acquire positive actions, positive habits, that's what we call the you know, accumulating positive deeds. But the more we accumulate positive deeds, what happens is the more we get purified. That's why they say, you know, this, there's this because the always from Buddhist point of view, it's understood that our actual kind of Buddha nature, you know, we have our nature is pure. So therefore, what needs to be done to bring that out is to get rid of the obscurations. You know, we talk about two obscurations. So therefore, then you know, to anything you do, whether it's from a positive side or negative, it's all to get rid of the obscuration. So therefore, it comes to the same thing, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what was the last one?
The second part was, how can merit, which is compounded, lead to Buddhahood, which is uncompounded? Mm-hmm.
So that's exactly the same thing. You know, merit is helping us to take out the obscurations, which is compounded. So when you take out the obscurations, then the nature of, you know, enlightened mind, you can call it, which is uncompounded, you know, is not created by that. There's no need to create it. You just need to get rid of the obscurations that we experience that. Clear, no?
Better to devote your life to study and practice solely, uniquely, in order to share this with others in the West? Or is it good to combine study and practice with working in the healthcare area where it is needed, like in palliative care? This is Chantal's question.
This is always said like, this is the traditional answer. Is that you have to see according to the time and situation. Yeah? And if, you know, a person's, you know, situation, yeah, it's usually said like this, that when you are young, you know, then you have to study. Then when you are in a situation where you can do more help to the others, then you should do that. Yeah? Then when you are, you know, in a situation where you can do more practice, then you should do that. I mean, according to the time and situation, and also at the individual's situations, you know. This is how it is said, that if that person is in a situation where you can really help a lot, you know, lots of people in many different ways, and then you don't do that, but you do something, you know, study or something else, then it would be not so good, because you could actually do lots of help. But if you are not in that situation, that you could do lots of help, but you could do some more study and you could do some practice, and that would be really useful for yourself, for making yourself more qualified to help others. And then if you don't do that, it's not, you know, it's up to the person's, you know, situation. Yeah? That's how it is said usually. Yeah? It's not that there's nothing like, you know, oh, this is first better for everybody. Second, this must be done. That it's not like that.
In order to prove reincarnation logically, it seems one needs to establish that mind and body are different. Scientists would equate the mind with the brain. How do you prove a non-material mind?
First, improve the material.
Yeah.
That's the Buddhist way of understanding, you know. What is the existence of matter? It's not saying that matter is different from mind or mind is different from matter. What it's saying is that matter is what we think matter as something is seen like that, but it is, you know, when you look at it deeply, you can do it through physics or you can do it through logics or whatever, but the matter is also just an independently arising thing. It's not matter as a, you know, real, truly existing, independent thing. Mind is also like that. So in a way, it's not really different in a way, because, you know, it's different. Well, I mean, when you can, if you really go deeply, you cannot establish as something existing on its own. Then we have to say it's, that's why it is said, you know, whether it's called matter or mind, that's the same thing. You know, if you say it's there, you cannot find it. You know, if you say it's not there, it's also there. It's the big, you know, it's the basis of every experience. So therefore, you know, it's a very, you know, it's a strange way. It's the way, it's interdependent way, or whatever you call it. You know. And that is something that, and because it is like that, so there is no reason why it should end, because there's nothing to end. Yeah? What is there to end? Yeah? So if there's nothing to end, then what do you call it? Reincarnation. Or rebirth, or, you know, a continuation. You know, that's called continuum. No, if something has no end, that's a continuum. Yeah. So if there is, whether it is there or not there, and that the way things which kind of continues. Cannot have something totally existing, or, because if it is really existing on its own, then it cannot continue. Yeah? Because, you know, it's existing now, and then, you know, it's kind of, it's immobile. It's it cannot fluctuate. It cannot change. It cannot, something that cannot change or fluctuate or, you know, transform or, you know, transient. Is something, it's very, you know, it's very difficult to establish. So therefore, it's not like that. There's nothing like that. So therefore, there is some kind of continuation. In what way and in what way it appears is, you know, also difficult to say, but, you know, I think that is, I understand, as a kind of most important logic to establish some kind of continuation, because there's nothing that can end. Yeah?
So would you say that the clear and cognizant awareness, that also is dependent arising, is dependently arisen?
Dependently arising is another, you know, a concept also. Yeah. The main thing is that, you know, it's our way of, you know, kind of habitual tendency that we have to say exist or don't exist. Yeah. Either it has to exist or it doesn't have to exist. You know, and if it exists, it has to be like a matter, you know, something, yeah. And if it doesn't exist, then it's like totally nothing. Yeah, that's our way of. That's our way of seeing. Yeah, we cannot, you know, we cannot. Kind of, it's very difficult for us to go beyond these two. Yeah, I mean, it's a when you have a what can you say? When you see, yeah, there has to be something seen, you know, something to be seen and something with which to see and action of seeing. No, if there is no form, then there is no. No seeing, no? If there's nothing to be seen, there's no seeing. If there's no sense of seeing, then there's no seeing. So, you know, seeing is also interdependent, you know, independently arising thing. Hearing is also, no? So therefore, everything is interdependent from that point of view.
In deep meditation, when there is that deep sense of just presence, and there's not so much that the awareness is engaged with the senses, then that, you know, it's not that the awareness arises because there's an object. So at that level, you know, of course I haven't reached the level where you know, it's the samadhi, so I don't know. But
how do you know it's there then?
what happens there?
There are lots of debates on that. I think maybe you have read some of the debates. I don't know. There is some debate about this. And that's where this, Rantung and Yentung kind of, a little bit there. Then you talk about kind of Rigpa and things like that, which is talking about an awareness without an object of awareness, yeah? Things like that. And then when that what we call the pristine awareness is then free of any, you know, like somebody said, any compoundedness or any causes or things like that, then it's there's no, because there's no causes, so it's not interdependent or dependently arising. Explanations. But you know, when we say that dependently or interdependently, also these are all kind of, in a way, talking from the relative point of view, yeah. And it's a way of explaining. So therefore, it's a the experience of that. You know, there's two ways of looking at things. No? One is that somebody who has that experience of, you know, fully seeing unobstructed or unobscured nature of our mind. Yeah? That experiencer's experience. Now, this is the understanding that from that point of view, then there is no question of, you know, causes and conditions and, you know, this and that, and no concept, no, you know. No concept means not no awareness. No concept means that no what to call it? No judgment. No, there's nothing that you need to assume. No assumptions. It's all direct experience. And that's what we call no concept. No concept means not completely, not like unexperiencing, not that. So from that point of view, then they say everything is perfect and everything is enlightened and there's nothing, you know, there's nothing, what can you say, no duality, no, you know. So then it's perfect and there's no kind of a, you can't say it's interdependent, you can't say it's independent also, things like that. That's one way, and that's the, you know, one way of experiencing, and that's how the Dzogchen and Mahamudra and Yantong philosophy is all based on. But then if you look at things from intellectual point of view, yeah, this is the, you know, if you analyze something, if you're at the point of analyzing anything, then you cannot find there anything that is, yeah, that's absolutely kind of, what can you say, there's nothing totally one, there's nothing totally, you know, independent, there's nothing totally. So therefore, everything has to be dependent arising. It's nothing that is. It's everything has to be emptiness. Everything has to be, you know, like that. Yeah. So that's why these two different philosophies, you can call it, are from these two ways of looking at. One is from the analytical point of view. You are looking with our, you know, you can say usual analytical mind and analyze the nature of things. Another is looking from an experienced point of view where, you know, the kind of almost enlightened mind experiences. So this is the different. Yeah.
I've received a lot of teachings on how to deal with desire, but it feels that no matter how much I contemplate on emptiness, desire is still the dominant emotion through which I perceive the world.
That's why, you know, analytical point kind of mind, you know, through analysis, whether you can, we can change your emotions or not, is difficult. That's why you need meditation. Yeah. Meditation is I think long and short of it is like this, I think. That, you first realize that mind is a very strange thing, yeah? There's nothing you can find, but there's awareness, and that awareness, the awareness means the knowingness. You know, this the desire is also an awareness, yeah, and that, you know, not only aware, but there is always manifesting. meaning that there's all sorts of thoughts, emotions, you know, perceptions, sensations, continuously arising. Yeah, you cannot have a mind without all those things. So that's nature of mind. Our nature of mind is emptiness, clarity, and they sometimes call it what? Unimpeded. Call it unimpeded. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it doesn't stop. You know? Now, the most important thing, I think, is this, that, you know, whatever arises, you know, now this thought arises, now that thought arises, this emotion arises, that emotion arises. That's not the problem. The problem is the way we react with those arisings. Yeah? Now there is a desire coming. And then say, I desire it. I desire it. Yeah? Or if there is anger coming, hate that. Or if there is compassion, or, you know, any good thing or bad thing. So when you hold on to that, you know, when you make, you react with that emotion or, you know, with a certain kind of grasping, yeah, this is nice. Yes, I want it. I need it. Yeah, this is not nice. I don't. You know, this is a way of reacting. Yeah. Now, the most important thing I think to deal with this is to understand that it's natural to have all these things coming up. So I just have to let it come out and let it go. Yeah. You understand what I'm saying? If there's desire, yes, now this desire is happening, yeah? Yeah. Not that, you know, when you are just looking at the desire as a desire, and then you just kind of, you know, what can you say? You just watch it, or you just, you know, relax in it, or you just... you know, you just you don't make a strong struggle with it. Yeah. Then desire arises, desire finishes, another desire arises, another finishes. So you can look at it and kind of watch it and kind of laugh at it, yeah? Because it's just, you know, like radiation, yeah? The mind is radiating and this kind of, it's interesting, yeah? Now it's now desire, now it's aversion, now it's fear, now it's this, now it's this. Yeah, it's like a very fast-moving, yeah, film. Yeah, then you don't involve yourself into it. Yeah, you don't make it very personal. You don't make it very, you know, reactive. But what we do is we kind of jump into it and we kind of, you know, now desire. I don't say this desire is happening from my... I say, I desire. Yeah? You make that desire very... personal and very kind of, you know, if I get it, then it's very nice. If I don't get it, it's very bad. You know, that's what we call grasping. Nah? So then we make it, you know, very personal. You know, that's what we call dualistic way of looking. Yeah? I am here and that's the desired one. And, you know, we don't see that this, you know, unimpeded manifestation of our mind, which is our nature. We just don't, you know, we just don't let it happen. you know, we are at every little thing, we are making a struggle, we are making a, you know, become very involved in everything, and then then we make ourselves very uncomfortable. Yeah. So that's not easy, because that's our habitual tendency. Yeah. First, it's very difficult to understand this, and once you understand that, it's difficult to actually let it happen. Yeah. And there the meditation comes in. That's where the whole practice comes in. Yeah. It's not only about desire, it's about any other emotions or reactions and things like that. So therefore, you know, I think I said it to you before also, it's not like Tilopa said to Naropa, the appearance doesn't bind you. The grasping binds you. This is the grasping. Yeah? And also this is how it, if it is said, I think we talked about this before also, many scientists, they have been watching His Holiness Dalai Lama. Yeah? And they are saying that, you know, he has all the emotions. They can see all his emotions. He sometimes gets upset. He sometimes gets sad. He sometimes gets angry. But they said that it changes very quickly. Yeah, it changes very quickly. You know, he's very sad now, and after a few seconds, he's laughing, his heartiest laugh. You know. So that's why, you know, when in the Dzogchen text also, it is said that the way to liberate yourself, you know, sometimes they say it's like writing on the in the water. If you write on the water, it just, you know, you can write it, but you know, it just disappears immediately. So, and the writing on the sand, you know, writing on the stone. Yeah? If you write on the stone, then it stays, you know. So we are doing, all emotions are like that, you know. Yeah. Very solid and very, you know. Then, if you write on the sand, it's much looser, no? So that's how you can, it depends on how much you can allow it to be, you know, allow it to go. And then writing on the water, then you can write, but immediately it's gone. Yeah. So this is, you know, that's exactly the realization. The degree of your realization, the degree of your achievement in your practice, in, you know, meditation, is of that. How much you can use this understanding in your actual experience. Yeah, it's not just wanting to be without desire. Is not the right one. You know, I don't want to have desire. It's a desire. Yeah. So, but it, you know, however much you want to be without desire, it doesn't, you know, because that's the way our mind is working. Yeah. So the way to do is desire, okay, no desire, okay too. It's, the desire is funny, no desire is also funny. Yeah. That's why the Longchenpa says, you know, like how nice to watch yourself, you know, the emotions. It's so so such a kind of a funny thing. That's it.
Rinpoche, we're studying the Umbala Jokpa, and of course, there's a lot of analysis there. So, with this specific text, what would you suggest is the best way for us to do actually contemplation and meditation?
Well, I mean, this text is an explanation of paramitas, no?
Mm.
10 paramitas. But so that's all to practice. You know, the practice of paramitas is the main practice, isn't it? So that's the practice part. The sixth chapter of Prajnaparamita is the, you know, the major part of the book, which is there's lots of, you know, analysis on that, and unlike the Umajen, Umajen, which only emphasizes one, you know, this one reason, one or many. Here it's many different, the four kind of different ways of looking at that. So these are analytical exercises. I think this is you can study those things. I think it will be good a little bit. But I sometimes feel that this the debates are the difficult part. Yeah.
Mm.
Because these are supposed to be debates with other philosophical schools at that time, and some of them are very, very deep and very vast, you know. So when we are discussing, you know, with the philosophical school, and you know, you have to first understand that, yeah, and that's quite a lot of study. It's very difficult to study the whole, you know, because it's lots of them, and there are lots of things which are quite, you know, important also. I think if you could, you know, if somebody could study all of them, it would be useful also, but it's a very big study. So we don't know much about those things. And then we're trying to, you know, negate them is kind of an impossible task, you know. We don't know what they are saying, and then I'm, you know. So that, I find, is most difficult part. So therefore, I don't know what to do. I usually shortcut to all those things too, because of course they are all kind of exercise, you know, exercise and different ways of thinking could be. But if you really ask some of them, you know, like some of the Hindu philosophies now, they don't say exactly like that. Yeah. I have discussed these things sometimes with the other, you know, like Sankhya philosophers or Vedantic philosophers and things like that. They don't say like that anymore. Yeah. They have, I don't know what happened, we don't know exactly. Maybe they have changed, maybe we have quoted them wrong, I don't know what, but it's not exactly like that. So it's a little bit, but I think it will be useful to use some of the, you know, if possible, I mean, for the study I'm talking about, to use it in our way of, you know, in the modern way of thinking or philosophy or things like that, and use the limit there, that would be, I think, useful thing to study. That's what I'm talking about, study. The meditation part, then it is, you know, this concept, that's the same thing, you know, when you come to that, you know, like, I think it's more or less what we have been discussing before, you know, the matter and mind. You know, it's not about the matter is not there, but mind is there, or mind is not there, but matter is there, or mind and matter are totally different or totally same, or, you know, it's not about that. When you understand that matter also is existing in a, you know, or not existing, or existing beyond all, you know, all the, what do you call it, all these extremes. How do you say that? Yeah, and mind is also like that, beyond all extremes. And that, trying to bring that experience of, you know, beyond all extremes. What do you mean beyond all extremes? It's not grasping. If you say it's emptiness, then it's an end. No, it's an extreme. Oh, it's all emptiness. You know, emptiness. You know, you make kind of emptiness as something, yeah, or nothing, yeah. And then you know you are grasping at that. You know, emptiness. That's not emptiness, yeah. Emptiness is not like saying nothing is there. Emptiness is peace. Emptiness is not grasping. Emptiness is allowing all things happening. Emptiness is without struggle. Emptiness is, you know, anything is happening, but nothing is disturbing anything, in harmony, yeah? So emptiness is not without any appearance. Emptiness is appearance, but not grasping. So when that understanding, that experience, that's the meditation, no? So the whole study of Madhyamika is to not to find something to grasp at, yeah? And that's the difficult part of this. You can go mad by studying Madhyamika, because, you know, if you have to find, what is this, you know? We have to, you know, we have to grasp something, yeah? It is like this. Yes, it must be like this. Now I understand. It must be like this. And then it's not like this. Then it must be like this. Now it's, yeah, now nothing. No, it's not. Because that's exactly what's the point of studying this. You know, there's, you know, there's nothing to grasp at, you know. And when you are not nothing, when you know that there's, you know, when you really find out, you know, experientially, that there's nothing to grasp at, then you are free from fear, yeah. Sometimes people have fear, you know, to understand emptiness and to understand, even the meditation, yeah. That fear is because you are trying to grasp, yeah. As long as you are trying to grasp and you cannot grasp, then there is fear, you know, because, you know, it must be like this, yeah. But when you really know that, you know, and really you can, you know, you learn how not to grasp, then there is no fear. And that's where real the peace, you know, and fearlessness comes. You know? So I think the main, what can, essence of the study, the, you know, the practice or the experience is that you learn not to grasp. Yeah? And when you learn not to grasp, that's understanding emptiness.
Rishi, I was wondering if you could say a little bit about this phrase, Tongyi Ninji Lingpo Chen, emptiness with compassion as its very essence. I feel like I've heard it, and I still don't quite understand what is meant there. Because usually I think of, you know, it's very difficult to think of compassion and love in the absence of sort of objects and subjects and so forth, and this whole idea of emptiness as being, you know, with its heart being compassion. I admit that I don't really understand what that means. Maybe
What prevents compassion? What is the main obstacle for compassion? Selfishness, no? Self, you know, self-centered, you know? I, you know? So what is it that changes that situation? Yeah? Emptiness. Emptiness, I mean, a kind of a genuine understanding of emptiness or experience of emptiness is supposed to, you know, eliminate that kind of self-centeredness, selfishness. Yeah? So when you are not selfish at all, or self-centered, have no self too much, you know, then what happens? Compassion? There's nothing else to do, no? That's it. I think that's it, yeah? So that's why it is said that, of course, you know, the worst kind of misunderstanding of understanding of emptiness can be that if you don't have, you know, oh, there's nobody, or there's nothing, so I don't have to, you know, I care for anybody. That's kind of worst problem of the misunderstanding of the emptiness. Yeah? That's why it's very much emphasized that emptiness is the essence of compassion. That's the enlightened emptiness understanding. You know, when you understand emptiness, you are not negating anything. You are not saying that this, you are not there, she is not there, he is not there, everything is not there. It's not like that. It's just understanding how everything is there. How am I? You know, what am I? So, when you understand that, then you know that you don't have to, you know, actually you don't have to suffer. That's what we call enlightenment, no? When you know that actually you are in such a, you know, you are actually somebody, then you don't really have to suffer. You don't need to suffer. You are in peace. You are happy. But then you know that others are suffering. And there's, you know, when you know that they also don't need to suffer, actually. It's just they didn't, you know, they don't understand something the way they are, so therefore they uselessly suffer. Then you have a, you know, genuine kind of wish that, you know, they should not suffer because there's really no need to suffer. There's no, you know, absolute, but, you know, they just suffer because they have some misunderstanding, some, you know, something that they don't understand. So that's the idea. Yeah, that's the, so the more you understand the emptiness, the more genuine compassion develops. Not like, I have to be compassionate, kind of. You know? I have to be compassionate, otherwise I'm... is in a kind of... It's also nice, but, you know, it's more... It's some... it's not so genuine, you know, it's a trying to be compassionate. But that kind of compassion is natural. It's not, you know, you are not trying to be compassionate, you know, you are compassionate. So that's why understanding emptiness brings the true compassion. And then compassion is the way. It's the opposite. The compassion is the opposite of all negative emotions. Yeah? So the more compassion you actually can generate, the less negative emotions you have. Compassion is opposite of anger and hatred. No, that's obvious. But compassion is also opposite of desire and attachment. Because attachment is me. Yeah?
Me.
And compassion is not only me. Like this, yeah? Jealousy, opposite. Compassion. Arrogance, opposite. So, you know, every negative emotion is the opposite of compassion. So therefore, more you generate compassion, the more you have the chance to experience the wisdom. Yeah? So therefore, these two, compassion, wisdom, compassion, emptiness, whatever you call it, are completely contributory to each other and, you know, and help each other. So that's why, you know, this, it's like that.
We often speak about to explain reality with the two truths. And then I was wondering if there was a link between the, when we speak about the ultimate truth as the union of emptiness and appearance, and these two truths.
Now, two truth is just a way of presentation, no? The truth is just two way. Two truth is a way of presenting the truth. Yeah. It's not really two things. It's one thing. To say that everything that appears is kunzop. Kunzop means what can you say? Illusory. Is the transcendental truth. It's the way everything is really illusory and nothing else is the ultimate truth, no? Actually, there's really no difference between the two truths. Everything is interdependent, everything is arising like this,